Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with threats made by Glenn Greenwald that he would publish secrets about England's spy system that would make the British, quote, sorry for what they did for detaining his partner at London's Heathrow Airport. NSA whistleblower William Binney, who served 37 years at the National Security Agency, rising to the rank of Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group, joins us to talk about the escalating war between the leakers and the governments. Then, on the 60th anniversary of the 1953 coup in Iran, we will discuss what the CIA finally admitted to in a declassified report that states the military coup that overthrew Mossadegh and his National Front cabinet was carried out under CIA direction as an act of U.S. foreign policy conceived and approved at the highest levels of government. Iranian-American historian Dr. Mazia Behrouz joins us to analyze the legacy of this less-than-surprising secret American coup that placed the Shah on the peacock throne. Then finally, we'll assess the fate of San Diego's embattled Mayor Bob Filner, now known as Filthy Filner, against whom a recall petition has just been announced. Stephen Erie, professor of political science and director of the Urban Studies Program at the University of California, San Diego, and author of Paradise Plundered, Fiscal Crisis and Governance Failures in San Diego, joins us to discuss the serial sex scandal enveloping America's eighth largest city. And joining us now is William Binney, who served 32 years in the National Security Agency and another 4 years in the military component of the NSA for a total of 37 years. He rose to the rank of the Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the National Security Agency. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Binney.
Thank you.
And you have been described as a whistleblower, and I think indeed you were a genuine whistleblower in as much as you tried to go through channels at the NSA, I understand, to report on waste and fraud and to be, in effect, a steward for the taxpayer. And I take it that they treated you like a criminal, did they not? They took away your security clearance. And were you arrested?
Well, I wasn't arrested, but I was raided by the FBI, and the Department of Justice attempted to prosecute me or indict me on three different occasions, all falsely. They were contrived charges. They were falsifying evidence to do it.
But you never took any classified material out of the NSA, and presumably if you would, they would have really nailed you, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they would have, yeah. They and in fact, they tried to do that with Tom Drake, but Tom didn't have any classified material, but what they did was they took material he had and did a review of it and said, well, let's classify this so we can charge him with having classified material. That's exactly what they did. But that didn't pass the smell test in court, and so their whole case fell apart.
Well, I just wanted to get a preface on your who you are in terms of a genuine whistleblower and get into the headline for today, or one of the headlines, of course, which was that David Miranda, who lives with Glenn Greenwald, who is the main leaker, if you will, of Edward Snowden's material, David Miranda was detained at the airport in London for, I think, about 9 hours, where he's interrogated. And then he finally was released and then went on to Rio de Janeiro, where he lives with Glenn Greenwald. And Glenn Greenwald met him at the airport there and made a statement at the airport that was pretty provocative in the sense that he's sort of challenging the British government. I mean, what was your response to what Glenn Greenwald said?
Well, I thought it was pretty much the case that I, from my perspective anyway, that both the British government and Glenn need to cool off a little bit. The British government needs to, if they have an issue with Glenn, they should take it up with Glenn. If they have an issue with someone else, they should take it up with someone else. You just don't pick people up off the street just because they have relationships with other people and treat them like that. So I would say they need to cool it off, and so does Glenn. So it's kind of, both sides are going to extremes in my view.
Well, what Greenwald said at the airport, just quoting him, is, I will be far more aggressive in my reporting from now. I am going to publish many more documents. I'm going to publish things on England, too. I have many documents on England's spy system. I think they will be sorry for what they did. And then he went on to say, they wanted to intimidate our journalists to show that they have power and will not remain passive. but will attack us more intensely if we continue publishing their secrets. So he's sort of laying down the gauntlet, but I find it extraordinary that a single individual could be in possession of so many secrets to the point where he could challenge a government, in this case the British government, but I imagine by extension he's also challenging the American government. I mean,
I think that's probably because they're desperate to find out how much material he really does have. And that's why they stopped him. But they shouldn't have treated him that way for that long. I mean, if they wanted to ask him questions, they could stop him and ask questions, but that's about it, you know, and then let him continue on his way. You know, if you want to harass people for long periods of time in an airport, I guess they can do that, but...
Well, they took his laptop and all of his thumb drives, right. And prior to that, there was a break-in in Glenn Greenwald's residence in Rio de Janeiro some weeks back, I think months back, when the Edward Snowden story first broke.
That's called a sneak and peek, yeah. That's what they do. Sneak, peek, and take.
Right.
If there was something there to take, I'm sure they would have taken it.
Well, I just wanted to get a sense, though, from you as a genuine whistleblower who blew the whistle on principle to protect the American taxpayer and didn't expose any American secrets to anybody that could be considered hostile to the United States. There is obviously a huge difference here with what's happened with the Edward Snowden case. And since Glenn Greenwald has been the main source of much of the leaks, there's some mystery as to why Barton Gellman of the Washington Post, what he has and why none of it's appeared, or very little of it's appeared in the Washington Post. But Glenn Greenwald apparently has been feeding stuff to the Guardian and has now threatened the British government in retaliation against them questioning his partner that he will release more secrets. One of the things that he also said he had and threatened to release was a blueprint of the entire architecture of the National Security Agency. So as a former senior officer in the National Security Agency, what would this mean if that were released?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I don't really know what he has. It could involve all their assets and all their sources of information and things like that. And that certainly would not be a public service to do that kind of release.
But
I'm not sure what he has.
Right, and I take it you are not sure whether the Russians or the Chinese have it as well.
No, I don't know who has it now.
Right.
So,
but doesn't this bring up a real question about when you said maybe the government and Glenn Greenwald should cool it? That's pretty much my response. You know, this thing's getting out of hand. I mean, if a single individual can threaten an entire government with secret material that he's holding, that doesn't sound like a whistleblower. That sounds, in many ways, a reflection of the same kind of imperious and bullying attitude that governments themselves adopt. So
right,
I don't
right,
see any winners in right. this, do you?
No, I don't either, and that's why I thought that they should both cool it. You know, the governments are acting in a bullying fashion, too. So they need to do things properly, I think, and above board.
So what would there be a mechanism? I mean, obviously Snowden himself said that there was nowhere he could go except out of the United States. And I think Dianne Feinstein and others said, no, he should come back and air his grievances here. He chose not to do that. And many people argue that if he had done that, he'd spend the rest of his life in jail, like Bradley Manning is being threatened with. So
after going through some term of torture, you know, or semblance of torture, yeah.
So what could be done then to find a way for both sides, you know, the government and the leakers to come to some kind of accommodation so that it's a win-win. The government gets to protect its secrets if indeed they're not already lost, and that the leakers get to have the public debate, which, after all, President of the United States, Barack Obama, called for.
Yes, but you have to question whether or not he really and genuinely meant to do that. Because, again, the question is, has he set up a mechanism where whistleblowers in the intelligence community have a means of getting their complaints aired? And if they're validated, like the DOD IG's office did with the complaints we filed, then what is the mechanism or what has he done to try to correct those problems? The point really is that nobody really wants to change anything. They want to keep it going the way it is. and it includes all the fraud, waste, and corruption, as well as outright lying and criminal activity. So, I mean, unless there's a means for that to be corrected and it's done openly where everybody can see it happening and see the corrections and a start, at least the process to correct things, then no one has confidence or trust in government.
Again, I'm speaking with William Binney, who served for 32 years in the National Security Agency and another 4 years in the military component of the NSA for a total of 37 years. He rose to the rank of the Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the National Security Agency. So within the House and Senate Select Committees of Intelligence, which came up, which were born out of a lot of scandals after Watergate, and there was a lot of public outrage, and these select committees were set up to be a kind of, you know, the people's watchdog, if you will, over the intelligence agencies. Is there anything within those committees that could be done, could be improved? Because there's a couple of senators who seem to be chafing at the bit to release information that they think the public deserves to know, but they are restrained from doing so. I'm sure you're familiar.
I think the committees have been co-opted by the agencies they're supposed to be overseeing, and they really don't do effective oversight. So, I mean, if you've ever watched any of their interviews or testimony given by the agencies like General Alexander or anybody else going down there to testify in those committees, all their questions are basically softball questions. They don't ask penetrating, inquiring questions. In other words, they're supposed to be more of an adversary than an advocate. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the point. And they're not. They're basically a part of the system that the agencies are, and they support each other. So it's not a question of them being able to do something. We need another check and balance on those committees.
Well, do you have, though, is there any possibility that in the closed sessions that there's a more vigorous give and take as opposed to the public sessions?
I rather doubt that because of the way the committee chairs and members are talking, most of them anyway.
Right.
They simply are pushing the line that the administration pushes and the agency pushes without any kind of adversarial view, you know, which is really why they were created. They were supposed to be adversaries. They're supposed to be doing hardcore checks and balances on what those people are doing. And obviously, since some of them have said they didn't know all this was happening, obviously they've not been doing a very good job.
Well, it's true. And as I mentioned, you know, Jeffrey Merkley, Senator Merkley, and Udall both seem to be chafing at the bit to release more information. And they've hinted rather bluntly that there's a lot more to the story that Snowden leaked in terms of these.
He just talked about a small portion of it, yeah, so far.
So when and if is any of this stuff going to be aired, or are we just – because the thing that concerns me about what's happening now with Greenwald and the idea that a person like Greenwald or a person like Julian Assange can basically declare war on governments – in a kind of, you know, like a Western gunfighter calling them out. What I'm afraid of is at some point or other, there could be a backlash to this, and governments could institute restrictions on the press to the extent that if you receive these leaks, you're legally culpable. In other words, legal contamination could be the next step if this kind of grandstanding continues to go on.
Well, I think that's probably one of their objectives, yeah. Especially like Jim Risen, they were trying to do that with Jim Risen with his with the leak originally, with the warrantless wiretapping, and then also the book that he wrote about CIA, I guess, and some of the things in that book. So I think that was the objective since then, and they've been trying to get around to that one way or another. So I think that's the objective of government. So it's to basically silence a free press.
Well, it would seem, though, that Greenwald's statements and Assange's behavior may actually be helping the government in moving in that direction.
Well, also it could be forcing them to expose their real intent, which may the point is that the public needs to react to what the government's doing as well as what Greenwald's saying and get involved and start to saying, here's what we want our government to do. They haven't been doing that so far, but there's a move now that's and I think Representative Amash and others in the House and in the Senate also are trying to move to correct some of this. Because after all, Representative Sensenbrenner, who wrote the Patriot Act, said that the interpretation they're using from that court order that they issued to Verizon to do domestic and intelligence spying on every citizen in the United States was not the intent of the, of his writing the Patriot Act. That was not the intent of Congress at the time. So that basically tells you that they have had this secret interpretation, and they've got they've had the FISA court basically do agree with them in secret. So this secret interpretation is reinforced by a secret court that issues orders in secret to people who aren't allowed to tell anybody. They have to keep a secret about it. So everything's being done in secret. And what that really means is we're ending up with a secret constitution that nobody really knows what's going on anymore. So that's really fundamentally destroying our democracy.
Well, and it was Representative Amash who, along with Congressman Conyers, brought that bill to the floor that was a very close vote on shutting down section the use of Section 215 of the Patriot Act. Also, Congressman Sensenbrenner, the author of the Patriot Act, has written an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times basically saying that the government's classifying too much information. There's just
That's true, too.
So
I think all of this really needs to be done, opened up and dealt with in the Supreme Court and ruled one way or the other, it's constitutional or not, and then terminated or not, according to the ruling. But I mean, you know, we can't just let this continue because they've twisted laws and made secret interpretations. And I mean, you know, this is not the way our democracy is supposed to be, that's for sure.
But just in closing, as a whistleblower yourself, can you see a fair mechanism that would have allowed, for example, Snowden to get a fair hearing, without having to run off and then end up in the hands of the Chinese and the Russians and have freelancers like Julian Assange and Greenwald in possession of an extraordinary trove of government secrets, which they can then threaten governments with, which is what Greenwald has just done? And, you know, on the other side, you know, you've got the example of Bradley Manning, and this kid could spend, 100 years in jail if he lives that long. So I'm just wondering if there would be a way to navigate through this without this kind of opera that we're watching now.
Well, currently, I don't think there is. But, you know, there have been moves afoot to try to do whistleblower protection acts out of Congress and so on, and to include the intelligence community whistleblowers in that act, which they currently are not, by the way. That's part of the problem. There's no real mechanism that would protect people coming down. Like when we tried to do that, there's nothing that protected us from the retribution of the NSA and the FBI and the DOJ. And that's exactly what happened to us. So I know that Snowden had watched what happened to us and also Bradley Manning, and basically made his decision based on that, which was to exit the country and take the stuff with him, or whatever he did with it.
Well, William Binney, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with William Binney, who served for 32 years in the National Security Agency and another 4 years in the military component of the NSA for a total of 37 years. He rose to the rank of the Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the National Security Agency. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the fact that the CIA has finally admitted that they were behind the 1953 coup that happened 60 years ago in Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Iranian-American historian Mazia Behrouz, who was born in Tehran and has taught at UC Berkeley and Stanford University and is currently a professor of history at San Francisco State University. He's the author of two books on the history of the Iranian left, Rebels with a Cause, followed by Perspectives on the History of Rebels with a Cause in Iran, a collection of interviews and articles on leftist movements in Iran that was translated into Persian and published in Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Mazia Behrouz.
Thank you for having me.
And the CIA formally acknowledged its key role in the 1953 coup, which ousted Iran's democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh 60 years ago in 1953. Obviously, no big secret, but my understanding is that there are still some people in the Iranian diaspora, those that support the Shah, the royalists, many of them here in Los Angeles, who don't believe the coup happened. Is that true?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that for the first 25 years after the coup d'etat, 1953 to 1979, that was the official line in Iran, that there was no coup d'etat. This was a people's revolt against a despotic prime minister in defense of the popular king. And only after 79, when the monarchy was overthrown, did we get the chance to hear the truth about it. So the royalists in Iran have never reconciled themselves with this historical fact. Actually, their concern has to do much less with facts and history than their political and ideological agenda. And no matter how much documentation you show them, if you bring the whole CIA vault and spread it in front of them, since their concern is not really historical fact and analysis, but their own political view of what they would like to believe what had happened, then you cannot convince somebody that doesn't want to be convinced.
But going back to Mossadegh, who was elected in 1951, he did weaken, according to the coup policy, he'd weakened the Shah and the Iranian army. What had he done? Because first of all, the idea of the peacock throne and the Shah, my understanding is that for as much as they talked about thousands of years of Iranian history and that they were this royal family, didn't the British find the Shah's father in a stable somewhere working? I can't remember what his role was, but he was hardly of royal.
The Shah's father came from humble origins. He was a military man, and he was an officer in a military unit in Iran. And he was half literate. He did participate in a British sponsored coup d'etat in 1921, representing the military wing of the coup d'etat as against the political wing, which was a journalist. Then he became the strongman of Iran between 1921 and 1925. He became prime minister in 1923. The strongman then turned against the ruling dynasty, the Qajar dynasty, and basically staged a second coup d'etat and put himself, the Pahlavi dynasty, as the new monarchy in Iran. So I guess that's the answer to your first question. The second question regarding Mossadegh is that he became prime minister in 1951, and he was toppled on August 19, 1953, 60 years to the date. Mossadegh, Iran had a constitution, and the constitution called for monarchy to reign but not to rule. And Mossadegh was a constitutionalist. He had a PhD in law from Switzerland. He was a lawyer. He was a JD. And he was a scholar of law as well as a politician. His concern was that the king should not reign. In that context, should not rule, should only reign, should be a ceremonial person. So in that context, next to the issue of oil nationalization, which he led the movement, his concern was to limit the power of the Shah, who was pushing from the opposite direction. The Shah, the second Pahlavi king, had never reconciled himself. He was like his father,
to rule by law and stay within the limits of constitution of Iran. That is to say, he wanted to rule and not just to reign. And that there lies in the middle of this the core problem and friction between Mossadegh, who wanted to strip away the Shah's powers, including his command of the military, and turn him into a ceremonial figure like the kings and queens and monarchies of Europe that we are familiar with today.
Right, but he wasn't even legitimate in the lineage that those monarchies have. He was literally a guy from the cavalry that the Brits had just put in there, you know, and anointed him as a member of this new royal family, the Pahlavi.
I wouldn't say it was exactly as what you said. The British did trigger him coming to power, but he himself, although he was half literate, was a very, very shrewd man, a very clever person, and he rose to power. And he became indeed, if he was a dictator and a despot who had little concern for Iran's constitutional law. On the other hand, he was one of the most important reformers of 20th century Iran in terms of bringing modernizing change to Iran.
But didn't the Brits finally get rid of him because he was quite friendly to Hitler during the war? I understand that there's
we are still talking about Shah's father, the last Shah's father,
yeah, exactly.
Reza Shah Pahlavi.
Yeah.
Yes. Iran was invaded in August of 1941. And the reason Iran was invaded was that the Reza Shah, the Shah's father, had declared Iran's neutrality. And yet he was faced with the demand of breaking that neutrality and aiding the Allies, in this case the British, because the Americans had not entered the war yet, helping the British help the Soviets, which were in dire situation after the invasion of Soviet Union by Hitler. Here he refused to do it. Now, was there a degree of closeness between him and Hitler and fascist Italy? There was, but this is, again, remember, I don't think he was a Nazi.
Right.
I think he was looking for a way of finding a reliable source of modernizing Iran, and he did not want the Russians and the British, who were the old colonial powers tormenting Iran for the past 100 years.
Right, but that does explain why paintings of Adolf Hitler are in the Iranian National Museum, I understand. But
Iran had a good relationship during his reign after 1925 with fascist Italy, and then after 1933 with Hitler.
Right. But let's turn again to Iranian-American historian Mazi Behrouz, who was born in Tehran and is professor of history at San Francisco State University and the author of two books on the history of the Iranian left, Rebels with a Cause, followed by Perspectives on the History of Rebels with a Cause, which is a collection of interviews and articles on leftist movements in Iran that was translated into Persian and published in Iran. We got a little sidetracked there, but I think it's still important history to understand the real nature of this dynasty that Americans love kings and queens. I don't know whether you've noticed this fascination with the royal baby in England at the moment, but most of it is pretty fatuous and false in the case of the Pahlavis. But my understanding is that things got really tense with the British over Mossadegh threatening to renationalize the oil, because the British Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which was now BP, British Petroleum, they were the first, weren't they? They were actually bringing gunboats in. They were really and the Americans stepped in to calm things down, didn't they?
Yes, during the first year of his premiership, 1951-1952, the British, who believed that the oil was theirs, Iranian oil was theirs, tried to get it back. They blockaded Iran. They put gunships outside Iran's territorial water. They blockaded Iran. They tried to assassinate and topple Mossadegh. Here, Americans intervened, the Truman administration, and prevented them. They took Iran to the International Court of Justice at The Hague. They lost. They took Iran to the Security Council of the United Nations. They lost. So during the first year, the American administration, Truman administration, did try to, quote-unquote, play the role of, quote-unquote, impartial go-between and judge between the two contentious power governments. But the Americans leaned, even here, they did lean toward the British, who were their allies, their ally. In this context, the Americans did try to prevent the Brits from attacking Iran, and they did try to facilitate negotiations between the two sides, which didn't work, actually, as we know. You know, the oil nationalization movement in Iran and Mossadegh's role is a classical anti-colonialist movement. It is about a weaker nation led by a aristocrat, PhD in law / politician, French-speaking, trying to lead the nation into nationalizing its national wealth, which was being looted by a colonial power, and reclaiming not only its wealth, but its national sovereignty. This is a classical context of this movement, which was unsuccessful eventually.
So, Mazeh Barouz, then, of course, the Truman administration lost power. Eisenhower became president, a different administration. And my understanding is, since I know personally some of the CIA participants in this coup, they basically got the took over the operation. It was an MI6 CIA operation, but largely became a CIA operation. They employed all kinds of people to destabilize the Mossadegh government, including, I believe, Ayatollah Khamenei, didn't they? They got the clerics out on the streets.
First of all, the Brits the British embassy was closed in Iran in October of 1952. So they lost basically their network in Tehran and in Iran was damaged. Even before the Eisenhower administration came to power, but after they won the election that year, the British approached the Americans and started to woo them, to court them toward accepting a plan that they had presented to the Truman administration and was rejected. It was then, remember, this is America with during McCarthyism. This is America during anti-communist paranoia. This is America during Cold War. This is an America which is really black and white rather than seeing things in shades and colors. So with the Dulles brothers in, the British showing that they could not come to any reasonable agreement with Mossadegh, and the threat of communism in Iran was, exaggerated, and Americans were convinced, really, to join this project, because if they hadn't done it, this could not have been executed, since the British had lost their network in Iran. So the Americans agreed to basically take up the cause and implement the coup d'etat. Now, in terms of what you said about Khomeini and the majority of the clerics in Iran were followers of a grand ayatollah of the time who was not very politically active and advised his followers not to get involved in politics directly and in for or against any particular person. Of course, all of these clerics were anti-communist, and they were worried about the threat of communism, the Tudor Party of Iran, the Communist Party of Iran. But as far as I can say, and I think history shows it, Khomeini was not actually involved in the events that led to the toppling of Dr. Mossadegh.
But a lot of clerics were, right?
a minority of clerics.
So, not a minority.
Ayatollah
okay.
Kashani, who disobeyed this grand Ayatollah that I just mentioned to you.
Right.
And there was another one. I mean, a minority of clerics were involved. The majority of them basically obeyed the request of this prestigious Grand Ayatollah.
But the CIA obviously got the military on side. They had the Shah in their pocket, and then they just got the mobs into the street. I mean, they got enough
and
people.
They did a lot of, and they did a lot of the disinformation. For example, they would call clerics' homes and other people of conservative background and pose as communists and threaten them. They would do these black demonstrations, you know, posing as members of the Communist Party of Iran, trying to scare more conservative layers of society into coming to the conclusion that if Mossadegh stays, what we're going to have is chaos, and a coup d'etat is preferred to chaos. So they did a lot of that. This was a very well-planned, basically, and well-executed operation, the Ajax I'm talking about.
Sure. Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, my understanding is, though, at the end of the day, the U.S. ended up very much the country that dominated Iran. The Shah basically did everything the U.S. wanted. They bought endless amounts of military equipment, etc. And the Brits eventually lost the oil, didn't they? I mean, it didn't. Not only was this an American coup that superseded British efforts, but didn't they end up with the lion's share of the oil as well?
Well, yes. The British never got back what they lost when Mossadegh expropriated.
So in other words, this was a coup against Iran and Britain, arguably.
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, but that was the reality of post-Second World War. I mean, the British and the French empires were unraveling, and that's just the reality. I mean, they had
right.
to take
it. But the only thing that the Brits had were the oil. I mean, that was an important asset, and they lost it. And the Americans ended up as the colonial power, in effect.
Yes, they did.
Right, okay.
That's an irony of history.
Right. Well, what's your thoughts, just in the last minute, on this 60th anniversary?
What is my what?
Thoughts. What are you thinking?
Well, I mean, I think it is two things are new and interesting, particularly the documents that were published today. One of them is, I think it's interesting that the CIA eventually is saying, okay, we did it. Although everybody knew that they did it, I think it's interesting that they say they did it.
Right.
And I think more detail was provided, which is really, it's not a game changer, but and for the monarchists and royalists in Iran who do not want to face reality, it's not going to change anything. But it shows very clearly how, on a detailed level, the American network and the British network in Iran were involved in directing mostly Iranian actors, military, thugs paid by the CIA, and even some civilians who joined in on their own, directing them toward basically accomplishing this task. So
right.
The documents are adding more information, more detail, but it's not a game changer.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
Dr. Mazia Bahrouz, again, an Iranian-American historian who was born in Tehran, has taught at UC Berkeley and Stanford University, and is currently a professor of history at San Francisco State University. He's the author of two books on the history of the Iranian left, Rebels with a Cause, followed by Perspectives on the History of Rebels with a Cause in Iran, a collection of interviews and articles on leftist movements in Iran that was translated into Persian and published in Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the recall launched against the mayor of San Diego, Bob Filner, otherwise known as Filthy Filner. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Erie, who is a professor of political science and the director of the Urban Studies Program at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Beyond Chinatown, The Metropolitan Water District Growth and the Environment in Southern California, and most recently, Paradise Plundered, Fiscal Crisis and Governance Failures in San Diego, which won the Best Urban Book Award from the American Political Science Association. He helped write San Diego's new strong mayor form of government, served on the Governor's Infrastructure Commission, and advises public officials, businesses, and community leaders in Southern California on the policy challenges facing the region. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Erie.
Great to be here, Ian.
And your mayor, who's now got a handle, Filthy Filner, I mean.
Filthy Filner and Groper by the Sea. This replaces, 10 years ago, Enron by the Sea. We are home to Groper by the Sea. And I'm afraid, Ian, that his greatest sin in San Diego is not groping 16 women, but subjecting America's finest city to shame and ridicule on late-night TV. It's a cardinal offense here. We're very thin-skinned.
Well, according to a poll that was just done in San Diego, 81% of San Diegans feel that Filner should resign, 75% say that they would sign a recall petition, and 20% said they would volunteer and work on the recall campaign, and 15% said they'd donate money to it. So what are the chances of a recall working, and how long will that take?
Well, a recall would work if we didn't have amateur governance in San Diego. There are unconstitutional provisions in the municipal code in terms of recalls. We had, after Gray Davis's recall at the state level, a court case. It's called the Partnoy case that declared the state election code on recall unconstitutional, i.e. the requirement that you have to vote in the recall election to vote for the replacements. Well, we've got the same language here. It's been sitting here for years. Nobody has bothered to change it to make it constitutional. The question is, with the recall that was launched yesterday, based upon an unconstitutional provision in the municipal code, what will happen when the city council finally next week gets around to changing the municipal code to make it constitutional and another 30 days for a second reading? Will we have to go back to square one in about 40 or 45 days and do this whole exercise over? This is full employment for lawyers.
Well, it's also going to be expensive. Doesn't the city have to foot the bill, which I believe is like $37 million?
You mean in terms of running an election? Yes. You know, we used to have odd-year city elections in San Diego, like many California cities, harking back 100 years ago to the Progressive era. In the 1990s, we moved from odd-year to even-year elections, i.e., the same time as state and federal elections, and it was all about saving money. It's just that people didn't realize the mayoral election is in a presidential year, and that's a great, great time for high turnout for Democrats.
And this is the first Democrat mayor that San Diego has had in how long? Several decades?
Well, in 20 years. But
20
this
years.
Is the first sort of Los Angeles or Bay Area liberal Democrat. The previous Democratic mayors, Maureen O'Connor, Frank Curran, we would call them in a place like L.A. dinos, Democrats in name only. They're centrist, they're moderate, they frequently vote with the Republicans. You know, Filner, as a liberal Democrat, was a marked man from day one in this town, certainly in terms of challenging the power structure, the prerogatives of developers, of hoteliers, and he did with relish. And then he handed them all of this in terms of sexual harassment and groping and whatever inappropriate comments and actions. He handed his opponents basically a weapon on a silver platter.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Erie, who's a professor of political science and director of the Urban Studies Program at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Paradise Plundered, Fiscal Crisis and Governance Failures in San Diego, and he wrote San Diego's New Strong Mayor Form of Government, served on the Governor's Infrastructure Commission, and advises public officials, businesses, and community leaders in Southern California on the policy challenges facing the region. Now, there's no question that San Diego is a very right-wing Republican town in an otherwise blue state of California. Big presence of the U.S. Navy. I believe a very right-wing billionaire bought the local paper, did he not? And you already had some pretty conservative mayors before Filner came along. You just told us that he's handed them a gift on a platter with his behavior. Their knives are sharpening.
Ian, if I can just interrupt, this was a red town. It has been trending purple for the last 20 years. I mean, it gave majorities to Barack Obama in terms of the presidential vote. The growth of the Latino population, the kind of high-tech workers that are involved in areas and industries around UC San Diego. It's really moved in a more democratic direction. In fact, Democrats now have the registration lead over Republicans in the city. But the power structure, the town's leading newspaper, the downtown business community is still resolutely Republican. Some would say right-wing, others would say ultra-conservative. But we now have a newspaper under Doug Manchester, hotelier, where he took a mediocre paper and turned it quickly into one of the worst newspapers in the country. It is yellow journalism at its worst. His conservative agenda, his financial interest represented on the editorial page, they don't just bleed into the news section. They hemorrhage. In fact, on Sunday, the Union Tribune, the UT San Diego as it's now called, basically had a section called All About the Recall that went well beyond the legal requirements of publishing news about a recall, and it serves basically as a campaign document for the recall movement. In fact, I've suggested only half in jest that they need to report what they've done as an in-kind contribution to the recall campaign.
Well, there's no question that this newspaper owner down there, and you're quite right, I mean, he does make Rupert Murdoch
Look like a lefty.
Look like a lefty, and a restrained and modest lefty at that. But in terms of Filner's resume, I mean, he worked with the Freedom Riders in the civil rights movement. He is a absolutely pedigreed all-American liberal, a very endangered species at that. The idea that this guy would get this kind of victory, make this inroads in this Republican power structure, and then allow himself to be, you know, what, sexually harass 16 women? I mean, and then go into therapy and then say he's had enough therapy and he's all ready to go back to work? I mean, there's something missing in...
Well, there's something missing here, and there are elements of a Greek tragedy. You know, such promise and yet, you know, such a turnaround in fortunes. Here was a mayor who came in promising to put the neighborhoods first rather than downtown. We've basically had downtown-centered politics, agenda, and benefits for years and years in this town, who basically took on the powers that be, the hoteliers, the developers, you know, did things like ended the red light cameras. This was very popular in this town. But the power structure and the dominant media were against him from day one. In fact, the UT San Diego, the editorial group, during the primary, it was recorded. They basically said, we want to make sure that the runoff has everyone but Bob Filner. They were against him from day one. He needed to be holier than Caesar's wife once he got elected. And unfortunately, that hasn't been the case.
And isn't there a very zealous city attorney, Goldsmith, who's tied into the power structure that's really...
Zealous is putting it kindly. He's rabid. He hates Filner, both personally. He's on the opposite side of the political spectrum as Filner. He's botched a couple of high-profile cases, the Bank of America case. He's also given the city council very dubious legal advice. There are many in this town who think that he's a political hack, a second-rate hack, and basically a lapdog for the downtown crowd. In fact, watching his behavior, I mean, he's going after Filner, trying to get the city council to remove Filner from office for fraud, for misuse of the city credit card, putting pizzas and juicers and a couple of high-priced meals on it. I mean, he's an elected city attorney, but he's the best argument I've seen yet for an appointed city attorney in this town, and he actually makes our former city attorney, populist Mike Aguirre, look much better in comparison.
So, but his overzealousness and incompetence still won't be enough to protect Filner from this avalanche that's coming down. He's got Gloria Allred, the well-known attorney, representing a number of the women that have been sexually harassed. And some of the women, one of, I believe, is a naval officer who had been sexually harassed inside the Navy. One is a great-grandmother. I mean, I wouldn't want to be Bob Filner's defense attorney. Would you?
No, absolutely. I mean, his conduct is morally reprehensible. The question is, I mean, this is probably a mayor who needs, right, basically a physical exam. Is it a prefrontal problem? He also needs to talk to a psychiatrist. There is something seriously wrong in terms of his behavior towards women. The interesting thing is, Ian, a lot of this was sort of known in the rumor mill during the mayoral campaign. Why did nothing surface? The DeMaio people, the conservative candidate, right, in the runoff against Filner, they went looking. So did the reporters in town. But I guess they had found a few women who claimed, but none of the women refused to come forward. I guess it took one, Irene McCormick Jackson, his Filner's press secretary, to start the avalanche, right? We're still waiting for the first woman who spent a lot of time with Filner to say, no, he didn't do inappropriate things with me. But that person hasn't stepped forward yet.
So has anybody, I mean, Nancy Pelosi has asked him to step down and get a clue, I think is what she said. Has he, to your knowledge, has anybody ever spoken to him? Did anybody ever speak to him at the time of the election saying, you know, you got to, you know, straighten up and fly right now?
Well,
they're out to get you, you know?
There were Democratic officials who knew about past examples of misconduct that went to the County Democratic Party to complain. The County Democratic Party evidently didn't do anything. Donna Frye went to Bob Filner before she went public and tried to get him to mend his ways, and I guess he sort of blew her off and forced her to go public. And, of course, that started because Donna evidently had talked to Irene McCormick Jackson, the former press secretary who's filed with Gloria Allred the sexual harassment lawsuit. But, you know, Filner, in a sense, right, has dug himself into an extraordinarily deep, deep hole. But the interesting thing is the more, Ian, that he stays in office and refuses to resign, the more it reveals about the nature of San Diego's political culture, power structure, and politics. As the other side, ever more desperate, right, tries to find new means to replace him. America's finest city is fast becoming America's finest banana republic.
So it's becoming a plague on both their houses then.
Absolutely. And right now, as I said, it's more revealing in terms of the overreach of an overzealous city attorney. He's grasping at straws trying to bring Filner down. Frankly, if they removed him from office from unauthorized personal use of his credit card for pizzas and juicers, basically the same standard applied to the city council, you wouldn't have a quorum. And the irony is that the conservatives in this town, who so pushed the strong mayor system, are in the process of gutting that system to get Filner.
Well, just in closing, Stephen Erie, you know, listening to this story about Filner, your mayor, as now, as I mentioned in the opening, is now referred to as Filthy Filner. It reminds me of, a little of Bill Clinton as well. Mm-hmm. And I remember having similar conversations back then during the Lewinsky affair.
Yes.
And one of the things that came to my mind, and I asked, remember asking some of the supporters of Clinton at the time about this, you know, remember Jack Kennedy had a real appetite for women. And
appetite is the word.
Right. And they had a couple of women on the National Security Council that were there called codenamed Fiddle and Faddle that would swim with him in the White House pool. And everybody knew what he was up to, but they figured this was who he was and this is what he needed. And that was how it was done then.
Yes.
And, you know, you think, you wish in ways that we had a culture like the French do, that could separate these things out, so these men who have this appetite wouldn't have to, you know, behave so desperately. I mean, there are professional sex workers out there that apparently can deal with these issues. You know,
so but you've got to pay them in cash rather than a credit card, as Elliot Spitzer discovered.
Well, that doesn't seem like a no-brainer, you know.
But here's the thing, you know, Filner came out of a Washington culture that's still, right, you know, there's a lot of, you know, don't ask, don't tell in D.C. You can get away with a lot more. But you come to a small town. I mean, San Diego may be the eighth largest city, but it behaves very much like a small puritanical town. You know, you've got to mend your ways. And he just didn't do it.
That's putting it mildly.
Mildly. Well, I'm trying to be diplomatic.
Okay. Well, I thank you for joining us here, Stephen Erie.
Okay, Ian, thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Erie, who's professor of political science and director of the Urban Studies Program at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Paradise Plundered, Fiscal Crisis and Governance Failures in San Diego, which won the Best Urban Book Award from the American Political Science Association. And he helped write San Diego's new Strong Mayor form of government, served on the Governor's Infrastructure Commission, and advises public officials, businesses, and community leaders in Southern California on the policy challenges facing the region. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.